You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 20th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, and for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kyla Schuler, author of The Trouble with White Women, A Counter History of Feminism. Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer's stunt has predictably failed. Republicans blocked voting rights legislation for a fifth time. As promised by Manchin and Sinema, Democrats' attempts to change the filibuster rules also failed. Another loss for Biden, who was on the defense 1 year into his presidency today. He spoke to the media yesterday, essentially admitting defeat, and advocated for breaking up Build Back Better into little pieces and trying to pass the parts independently, which the Republicans will just filibuster, so... U.S. jobless claims have risen to a three-month high, which is especially awful given the fact that the child tax credit expired, as have pandemic extended unemployment and eviction protections. The Supreme Court has ruled against Trump, with only Clarence Thomas dissenting, especially not in the studio. I would not like that. And has decided that the January 6th committee can have access to Trump's White House documents. Not good. If even the CIA says Havana Syndrome is BS, it's BS. An internal investigation has found that it is, quote, unlikely that a foreign actor is using a space laser to give intelligence officials headaches. Turns out they're just paranoid and or hungover.
Well, good thing we did all that speculating about it.
Yep. And lastly, in Minneapolis, protesters physically blocked cops from evicting a homeless encampment in the North Loop, and they were successful in stopping them. So, a little bit of good news at the end of headlines here. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen, is the Majority Report. There we go. I was up late a little bit last night. I went to the Ranger game, and it was a historic win where they were down 3-1 after the first period. Then DJ Pauly D of Jersey Shore fame, which is a show that I really did enjoy for quite a while.
He subbed in?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, he put on pads. He DJ'd for some reason in between the first and second period, which I'm like, but there's two intermissions, so like, when do you decide? But he did, and then it gave the team some magic, and they won 6-3. So it was a fun time for me last night.
What songs did he play? Anything stick out?
Just like remixes of a Bieber song.
Some LMFAO.
Some LMFAO type stuff. I was just like, and I don't understand DJing, right? You're just, you know, he's moving his fingers around and...
Looks like you understand it pretty well.
Yeah, but how do you, what are you physically doing? Why not just do that in advance and then press play? And then press stop.
Because in the moment, it's sometimes fun to put your hand on the record to make it slow down or speed up.
Okay, well, I mean, then to me, that sounds like I could do that. It sounds like I could do that.
And well, I don't know. Maybe we should talk to Madison Square Garden staff. Honestly,
I'm offended that they do a celebrity cam. They never even approached me about this. That's
DJ Emma V.
Oh, Jesus. I hate that whole scene.
DJ Vig.
I feel like there's a lot of, like, DJ Vig, yeah. There's a lot of rich kids that don't know what to do with their lives that are DJing in this world. Yeah. That's not for me. Anyway, on that note, let's talk about Build Back Better. Biden held a press conference yesterday to talk about his first year in office. I would say he's commemorating it, but... I don't think that even he is pleased with the job that he's done, because despite the fact that he is an aggressive centrist and a dinosaur of a Democratic politician who has a lot of old school perspectives, he did want to achieve something in his presidency. He didn't want to be a lame duck after year one, which is how it's kind of starting to appear. Build Back Better appears to be dead, and I think it's dead because of Joe Manchin and because Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer did not fully grasp who they were dealing with and did not do a full court press in an aggressive messaging campaign and pressure campaign in the lead up to these negotiations, even though Schumer behind the scenes understood that Manchin wanted to cut it down significantly. They started at $7 trillion. That was Bernie Sanders' proposal. Cut down to 3.5, then cut down to 2.2, then 1.8, which...
And, like, the last ones were done after while a signed document existed saying, actually, it's 1.7.
Yes, right, or 1.75 or whatever Manchin actually proposed. So all of these negotiations, at least in public, appeared to be... they tried to portray them as good faith. But in reality, Schumer and Biden pretty much knew behind the scenes, now this is what Manchin wants to do, which is like, why would you set yourself up in that way? There was hope that they could drag him along and that this number was not going to be the thing that he stuck to. They didn't. He cut it down significantly. And then once his proposal was the one that they were going to adopt without the extension of the child tax credit, Manchin was like, actually, I don't want it anyway.
I think they weren't expecting a massive another bout of COVID. And I think, I'm kind of convinced that Biden, like, I agree with you that he would have rather have got it passed now. But I also think that they thought they were going to have a super, super strong economy.
Yeah.
And be crushing things right now. And people wouldn't be worried about some of that stuff. Or it would go down a little bit less bitter than it has now, which is, like you said, like, we have rising unemployment. And a couple of weeks ago, only Jen Psaki said, we're not going to pay people to sit on their couch at home, right?
Yeah, sending you tests in the mail. That's ridiculous. Fast forward to the fact that now they have to do it, even though the Omicron wave might be falling off a cliff soon enough, although we are still in the thick of things. But all that said, here is Biden responding to a question from reporters on Build Back Better. And essentially, he has adopted the position that some centrist Democrats in the House who feel that they are vulnerable have taken, that we need to break Build Back Better up just so we look like we're passing something, essentially. Now Biden is on board with that.
Your comment that you made, that you're confident yes. that major chunks of Build Back yes. Better can pass, are you breaking it up?
Does that yes. mean? Well, it's clear to me that that we're going to have to probably break it up. I think that we can get, and I've been talking to a number of my colleagues on the Hill, I think it's clear that we would be able to get support for the $500+ billion for energy and the environmental issues that are there, number one.
Can you pause it for a second?
Number two...
unless that goes through reconciliation, why do you feel that you can get the votes that you need? Because a reminder that the filibuster still exists, and unless a climate bill goes on its own through reconciliation, they'd have to redo this process all over again, the Republicans are going to filibuster it.
Emma, he's talking to his colleagues about it, okay? I mean, what more do you want him to do?
I'm so glad that he has assuaged our fears by telling us tales of water cooler chit-chat.
Yeah, the guy who's surprised by the Republicans' obstructionism somehow is going to be leading this. Stuff, right?
Somebody who's worked with Republicans his entire career is just shocked that they are who they are. We'll get to that in a bit, but continue.
I know that... the two people who've opposed, on the Democratic side at least, support a number of the things that are in there. For example, Joe Manchin strongly supports early education, 3 and 4 years of age, strongly supports that. There is strong support for, I think, a number of the way in which to pay for these, pay for this proposal. So I think there is, I'm not going to I'm not going to negotiate against myself as to what should.
Real quick, those people support minority rule more than they support those other things. They like to say they support the other things because that's, you know, good for campaign literature. But the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah. Continue.
It shouldn't be in it. But I think we can break the package up, get as much as we can now, and come back and fight for the rest later.
You can't do that, though, because I'm like, I don't know why I'm explaining the rules of reconciliation to the Biden. Well, maybe they know this and they just want to look busy, right? It's the equivalent of you're working on a desk job and your boss walks behind you and you pull up an Excel spreadsheet when you were actually on YouTube. That's what he's doing here. Because unless you, there is the only way to get these things through, because you're not going to get 10 Republicans on board, is to go through a reconciliation process. And that means you have to
get your senators on board.
And that means you have to do one big bill. One big bill. So that is the only solution here. Breaking it up kills Build Back Better. The only thing that's on life support at this point, the only thing that might resuscitate it, is if there is a public campaign against Manchin and even Sinema to this point. Where, honestly, I would love if universal pre-K passed and we just got a little bit of something, but it is pathetic that we're at this point. And the climate provisions, which are so, so necessary. So that is the only path forward. And Biden is deluding himself if he thinks that he can now work with Republicans again on smaller provisions to get past a 60 vote threshold. At the same time that he's publicly talking about how, what are Republicans for? People were giving him a lot of credit. Oh man, you know, Biden's finally taking it to the Republicans. He's not, though, because he's still under the same delusion here if he thinks that he can break up these provisions and pass them independently.
Yeah, and I mean, this sort of veil of not comprehending reality about Republicans, Matt Fuller of the Daily Beast tweeted out, it'd be interesting in my lifetime to see what a Democratic president could do by starting from the assumption that they will get zero help from Republicans to enact their agenda, even the popular elements and needed elements of their agenda. And I mean, I said about that, you know, recognizing reality would compel a confrontation with the moneyed interest in the Democratic Party itself, that everybody who say supported Joe Biden over Bernie Sanders, that was the whole point. It was, we don't need to actually confront the party itself. We just need to win and, you know, get enough blue bodies in there. And we're seeing the failure of that. And all these people that were, you know, getting very solemn about Bernie's theory of change and will it work? Joe Biden says, like, died right in front of us, and we should take note to recognize that.
We should, but I mean, how many times have we even seen this? I mean, we saw it under Obama too. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The substance of what is done takes a back seat to temporary victories and electoral success and career success for those very people. And amazingly, the press buys that too, because they're as protected and inundated in many ways.
And Manchin and Sinema are going to get what they want, because when Biden has to sell these achievements, the bipartisan infrastructure package, that's going to create the sort of voter turnout that Manchin Sinema like the people that, not like these people who are grasping for the extra $2,000 in Georgia. Those people are inconvenient. It's going to be those people who actually are excited about bipartisan infrastructure, which is to say not very many, and they're probably going to get creamed. But where they win, it's going to be, you know, I mean, it's cultivating a certain type of moderate turnout, I think.
And I'm always yes-handing you, but that's exactly what the Democratic donor base now consists of. And they have made a conscious effort, and Biden is an example of this as the president. They've made a conscious effort. We are going to pivot to upper middle class suburban voters in certain areas because it helps us financially, and because we don't necessarily need to do a ton. We can, those kinds of people, very sympathetic to something like let's restrict gun rights. We're not going to do anything about it because that would require some filibuster rule changes, but we're going to fundraise off of it, and then we'll take the emotion of those kinds of people and parlay it into career success for us, independent of what we're going to deliver for people. And so, just to bring it back to Build Back Better here, do not listen to these centrist Democrats, corporate Democrats in these purple-ish districts, because these kinds of people are likely to lose regardless of whether or not Build Back Better is broken up and they can say, look at what I got done. They're going to lose anyway. The best chance to actually get something done for people and deliver a tiny, tiny sliver of what is necessary is to keep it intact to at least some degree and pass it through reconciliation. All right, we have to take a quick break. And I want to tell you, I know, right? I want to tell you about our one of our favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake CBD. All CBD tinctures will be 30% off. There's a sale coming up here. The sale starts, or did start, on Tuesday, the 18th, and ends next Tuesday. So you have a few more days to order off this sale. 30% off all the CBD tinctures. I used it last night with melatonin to try to get to bed after I was a little electrified after the game that I went to. It was one of the best games of the season for the Rangers. And it helped. I was able to fall asleep a little later than I wished because I try to get up earlier when I'm hosting the show by myself. But once I did take it, I went to sleep. And I've been using the new Mega CBD tincture also after work sometimes. Orders over $100 will receive a free 750 milligram tincture, a $30 value for free. No promo code needed. Products will automatically be discounted at checkout. So some of these new products here, the 750 milligram, 1500 milligram, 3000 milligram, 6000 milligram tinctures. They're now available in two new flavors, mint and citrus. And there's a 600 milligram full spectrum tincture. Sunset Lake CBD is releasing release those new flavored tinctures, and they're really great. I have the natural flavored one, but Sam says he really likes the mint.
I've been munching on the gummies the last couple of days, so if you've been liking my vibe lately, it's maybe attributable to that.
I've definitely been liking your vibe, and I love those gummies. They're actually they taste so good that I have to stop myself from eating so many more, because I'm the kind of person, I love gummy candy. I really do. And that's what it tastes like. So if you do get those gummies, they're really excellent, but just make sure you don't have too much, because that's very easy. So again, this sale is happening Tuesday to Tuesday. So next Tuesday it ends, 30% off. Orders over $100 will receive a free 750 milligram tincture, a $30 value for free. Visit sunsetlakecbd.com to try these amazing new products and take advantage of this sale while it lasts. Sale ends January 25th. Let's take a quick break. I gotta get some more water. And then when we come back, we are going to be joined by Kyla Schuler, author of The Trouble with White Women, A Counter History of Feminism. We are back, and we are joined by Kyla Schuler, author of The Trouble with White Women, A Counterhistory of Feminism. You are also an assistant professor of women and gender studies at Rutgers University. Kyla, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So, I mean, we have talked about the it's the favorite topic of mine, talking about the perils and pitfalls of white feminism and what it represents. And we've talked about it on the show before, but your book described it in such a succinct way. And I loved this definition. White feminism is theft disguised as liberation. Can you explain what you meant by that? And we can start there.
Yeah. I really wanted to understand the details and contours of what white feminism is and does when I wrote this book. And, you know, I think it's so useful the way that people are using this term widely to understand the kind of feminism that is putting gender above all and then ends up as a result actually leaning into other forms of inequality, like structural racism and capitalism and climate change
Lean in there, right? Did you do that on purpose?
Exactly. Exactly. And because of putting gender above all. But I found that one of the most common ways that we talk about white feminism doesn't actually fully grasp the full extent of the problem. And that is that one of the most common definitions is white feminism is a kind of feminism that ignores women of color, poor women, and other marginalized folks. And I found that that idea that white feminism ignores more marginalized people actually is too benign. It underestimates the threat, the extent of the problem, which is that the trouble with white feminism is not that it is committing a sin of omission. It's actually an act of dispossession. Mm. It actually ends up reinforcing other forms of inequality in the struggle to get women to the top. And Sheryl Sandberg being a perfect example of working so hard, as she argues, to get women to be corporate CEOs in contemporary capitalism. The problem is that if the goal is getting women to the top of our current structures, you actually end up reinforcing some of the other inequalities that have created that hierarchy in the first place.
So it kind of creates, it redefines white feminism as an action, as active, as opposed to kind of the more passive exclusion in the way that it had been previously discussed.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great way of putting it. And then it also means that the solution to it needs to be more active also, right? The solution to white feminism is not only including people of color, the poor, trans people. It needs to be more active than that. The solution is actually to dismantling the idea that we can't have a feminism that is ever separate from the fights against racism, wealth inequality, and many of the other structural inequities we have today.
So would you say that the white feminism has defanged and depoliticized the feminist movement to a degree? I mean, I know that's not a direct process, and often that's, that's just sometimes what happens. Like, I feel like we saw over time, like I feel like we saw an example of that with MLK on Monday, right? I mean, every brand is tweeting out quotes from MLK, and every Republican politician has no problem with his name. And I feel that there's a very similar thing that has happened with feminism that you describe.
I think the problem might be a little worse than that, though, which is that it's less that it has depoliticized a feminism that fights for real equality, and more that there have always been two distinct different kinds of feminism that actually have competing politics. And one of those is white feminism that is quite cozy with empire, etc. And the other is intersectional feminism, which fights for a broad-based structural equality for all. So, for example, one of the most shocking details I found when I was researching this book was that, according to a recent poll, 42% of women who vote Republican in the most recent elections consider themselves feminists. So it's actually that there is a strong, active, conservative, even sometimes explicit white supremacist feminism alongside this other form of feminism that supports things like Black Lives Matter and police reform or abolition. And recognizing that there is different kinds of feminism, I think, actually is one of our central struggles.
So what does white supremacist feminism look like? I mean, often you find you see tiki torches in men, right? In Charlottesville, if you're thinking of that in like the past 5, 6 years. But that, what you're saying makes total sense. It's not incompatible. It's just maybe that it's not represented in the way that we think about white supremacy in our cultural ethos.
Yeah, in a less obvious way, it looks like Ivanka Trump in 2016 on the campaign trail saying, "My dad is a feminist." In a more explicit way, it looks like the work that sociologist Jesse Daniels has found in researching online platforms like Stormfront and other white supremacist sites, that there are actually active groups of women on these feminist subthreads on these sites, people who support pay equality, people who support some kind of gender balance at home in terms of sharing workload, and even people who support abortion in these white supremacist sites, but often with a caveat that they support abortion for people of color because they want to prevent more births by people of color, but they don't support abortion for white women because they want to protect a white majority.
Well, that's interesting because that goes into one of the historical examples that you do cite in your later chapters, Margaret Sanger, I believe, right? We can get into that for sure. I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the modern examples and then go into that because you mentioned empire there and you write about how white feminism works alongside or works with racism, capitalism, and empire. And the empire thing struck me because another contemporary example, George W. Bush came out after Biden withdrew from Afghanistan and was saying, well, what about the women? What about the women in Afghanistan? And that is another, I think, great manifestation of this dynamic, or not great, but a great example of this dynamic that you're describing.
Absolutely. And especially when it comes to women in the Middle East, that has been a major thread actually for 130, 40 years, that it is the goal of white women to help save women from supposedly less civilized societies. The theorist Gayatri Spivak put it really well in the 1980s. She said it's the rhetoric of white women trying to save brown women from brown men. And it ends up actually just reinforcing the idea that the U.S. is a beacon of progress and white civilization, and that you can use feminism as a, not just a cover for imperialism, but an explicit rationale for imperialism.
Yes, it's totally twisted, but I mean that is a view that a lot of people hold. Like during the Afghanistan war, I believe there were protests about, you know, save women from the Taliban by women in this country, and it's it is very, very narrow. And I guess I do want to now dive into the chapters of your book where you do this great thing where you pair a white feminist from a time or a topic with a black or indigenous or trans feminist of a similar period, and you highlight these contrasts. So I guess we can start with this first example, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frances E.W. Harper. Can you talk about their stories and how they contrast and converge?
Yeah, I was really interested in this book and not just telling a critique of white feminism, but showing that white feminism has actually been sidestepping a vibrant form of feminism for true equality all along. And so the first chapter contrasting Stanton is particularly dramatic, I think, because, you know, Stanton is often considered, with her and Susan B. Anthony, her compatriot in the movement, as the founders of feminism. And as the most primary significant feminist actress of the time. But Stanton and Anthony both, in the wake of Reconstruction, actually reinforced racism as a way to further their own their own aims. That's because after Reconstruction, Black men were awarded the right to vote, but not white women. And Stanton in particular gave many, many racist stump speeches where she used all kinds of derogatory language and saying, and said things like, you are letting the most ignorant, debased, degraded elements of society vote, but you are not letting your pure, white, potentially Mayflower descendant wives who are vote, and therefore you're denying a moral force in society. She's the name we have. She's the statue we have in Central Park. And yet there was always another kind of feminism that I think is especially exemplified by the poet Frances E.W. Harper, who is a person many people probably haven't heard of. Even though she was a writer who sold 50,000 books in the 1860s, which is an astonishing number for that era. And she was raised so much money from her books and her lecture tours that she actually was a major funding source for the Underground Railroad. She gave hundreds and hundreds of lectures a year on women's rights, and women's rights as a partner of a post-Reconstruction movement for Blacks to gain land, literacy, and liberation was her framework. Hers was a framework for Black self-sufficiency and resilience and sustainability that meant actually getting control of some of the means of production. It was quite different from a message of the purity and morality of white women that Stanton offered. And yet Harper has been largely erased from feminist history outside of some academic circles.
And is that because of the intersectional feminist? Or, I mean, I guess I'm asking you to editorialize a bit, but how would we herald our white members of history to a degree that's very odd and also racist. But also, would you say that that's a largely deliberate suppression of that kind of feminism because of the multi-pronged nature of that feminism and how many things it challenges, including capitalism?
I think so, right? We're so accustomed to the idea that feminism means the belief in gender equality. That when feminism comes along with all these other campaigns also, it looks like, well, that's a Black woman's issue. Instead of, oh no, this is a feminism that's actually recognizing if we are going to redress the effects of slavery in the US, that means actually changing our structure of social relations, of our economy, of the idea that you can sacrifice entire populations for the bottom line. It looks a lot more complicated than feminism. And what's fascinating is that that suppression, as when you look at the historical record, you can actually look exactly when and where it happened. We don't have to make conjectures about, it probably got sidestepped. We can actually see, yes, it got excluded. And that's because the first time that anyone thought there could be such a thing as a history of feminism or the women's movement was when none other than Katie Stanton and Susan B. Anthony themselves sat down in the 1880s to write the history of the women's movement. And they produced a 4-volume work that has become the set of records for historians up till now about what feminism looked like. And they deliberately left Harper out of the volume. They had had so many battles with her on platform stages of conventions around the country that they left her out. And instead, they really elevated Sojourner Truth. And they turned Sojourner Truth into a figure who only supported women and left out her critiques of racism. And actually, we even used versions of Sojourner Truth speeches that were written by white women and made her sound like a plantation mammy, when in fact she was a speaker of standard English and was not from the South. And the original transcriptions of her speeches look nothing like the anti-woman version of Sojourner Truth we've inherited today from Stanton and Anthony.
That is, I mean, unbelievable. I mean, it is believable, but it's just unreal. Like, and two, how deliberate, you wrote about how deliberate Stanton's pivot really was to racism is interesting as well. Can you flesh that out?
Yeah. What's interesting about her pivot is that there were there were preludes there all along. She had long supported the idea that women needed the vote because they were the most moral, upright figures of society. And when they fully joined the democratic process, the idea was that they would help redeem the nation as a whole. From her very first speech to the New York State Legislature, she established her own authority as a Mayflower descendant and a descendant of a Revolutionary War hero. So she really leaned into the fact that she was what she called, you know, blue-blooded and was belonged to the richest family in town.
That sounds a little white supremacy-y in and of itself.
Exactly. I mean, she was also an abolitionist, right? But if this is a kind of abolition that supports the end of slavery, but isn't willing to go all the way to eradicating racism as a structure. But after 1865, then it became much more a battle. You know, Susan B. Anthony said things like, "I will cut off my right hand before I give the vote to black men before women." And she had long been a partner and collaborator with Frederick Douglass. But when she started giving speeches, you know, major convention speeches, railing against immigrants from China, immigrants from Ireland, against Sambo was a term she used regularly, and actually joined partnership with a very notorious white supremacist newspaper magnate. Then she lost many of her allies, and people like Frederick Douglass and Frances Harper actually broke away from Susan B. Anthony and formed a whole new organization that fought for women's rights alongside black rights, because Susan B. Anthony's organization really became about white rights above all. One of their proteges actually would even say in her stump speeches, "White supremacy will be strengthened by women's suffrage."
And so it's a deliberate political pivot, and the sadness of it is that did lead to some success, and like that's would it be fair to say that is the birth of white feminism today?
Yes, absolutely. And what's so harmful about it is that so often it's deemed the birth of feminism, right? Instead of the birth of white feminism alongside this other feminism led by people like Harper and to some degree Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass and others, which we could now call the birth of intersectional feminism. Even though that term intersectional feminism wasn't actually coined until the 1980s by the legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw.
So I guess let's move a little bit forward. I want to go through a lot of these examples, but let's talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe versus Harriet Jacobs in this time period. Tell us a little bit about the way in which I don't know how to describe it, but there was a contrast in the way that white versus black feminists were owning their own power to a degree. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Harriet Beecher Stowe, of course, wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was the second best-selling novel of the entire 19th century in the United States. And it's a novel that really positions white women as the saviors of enslaved people, that they will be the teachers, trainers, really discipliners of their servants and of the enslaved. And that's part of her vision of abolition. Versus Harriet Jacobs, who is another really compelling figure, you know, extraordinary figure, actually, and someone who it's amazing we don't have five movies about Harriet Jacobs' life. Because one of among many things that she did was when she self-emancipated from slavery, to run away from her enslaver, she actually hid in a tiny attic space, so small she couldn't even stand up. And she hid there for 7 years until she had the opportunity to take a boat north and escape North Carolina. She wanted to tell her story to support the abolition movement in the 1850s. and had a colleague approach Harriet Beecher Stowe to say, hey, could you write this person's story? Harriet Jacobs escaped in part because of the sexual abuse she was suffering at the hands of her enslaver. And they thought, well, Harriet Beecher Stowe might be the right person to bring that view of the sexual abuse element of slavery into the national eye. Instead, Harriet Beecher Stowe said, thank you for telling me these details of this amazing story of her hiding in an attic for 7 years. I'm going to use these details in my next book. Goodbye. And then never replied to any of the increasingly desperate letters afterward saying, no, we're not asking you to steal this woman's story. And Harriet Jacobs was so incensed that she actually wrote her own story. Like, she was lucky enough that she was literate from youth. And it is now, deemed the most important woman's slave autobiography. She's the first Black woman to publish her own story. And she actually literally published it herself because she couldn't find a publisher to support it. And it's a brilliant example of the kind of self-determination that guided intersectional feminism. And meanwhile, Harriet Beecher Stowe becomes the sort of patron saint of abolition. And then after Reconstruction, she and her husband bought the largest orange plantation in Florida so that she herself could experiment with disciplining and civilizing the formerly enslaved. And they're really dramatic examples of that sort of self-led versus white maternalist version of feminism that tried to enact a literal theft.
And that brings us back to, what we were talking about with Afghanistan, where there is this, it's just a thread through colonialism as well. We are going to civilize this population, and it's all inherently very narcissistic, of course. And I don't want to, we had someone write in to ask you a question, and so I don't want to move past that, even though we're going a little bit backwards about Stanton. Margot from Mass writes in, I had read that Stanton and the early conferences were originally urged to work for suffrage by Frederick Douglass, and they didn't agree on it as a goal until Douglass encouraged them to fight for it as a means to get other rights. Is that true?
It is absolutely true. It's really one conference, the conference is often considered the start of women's rights in the U.S., and this is the famous 1848 Seneca Falls Convention. And Stanton had said, we want to support the fight for women to vote. And nobody would support it until Douglass stood up. And Douglass was the only Black person in the entire many hundred person convention. And he said, I will not fight for my rights without fighting for the rights of women. And then the vote passed. But it wouldn't have passed in 1848 without Douglass, which made her later betrayal of him and of the rights of African Americans especially poignant.
I mean, it's especially disgusting. I mean, yeah. True. Thank you for that question, Margot. I want to move a little bit forward because I mentioned the Margaret Sanger example earlier when we were talking about reproductive rights and how, or when you were mentioning how these white supremacist sites are in favor of abortion but only for non-white people to make the population more pure, more white, etc. Talk a little bit about the contrast between Margaret Sanger and Dr. Dorothy Farabee, if I'm pronouncing
it. Yeah, it's a contrast that has a lot of consequence for us today. And that contrast can be summed up in present day terms as a difference between fighting just for reproductive choice, which is represented by Sanger, or reproductive justice, which is represented by Farabee. So what those terms mean is that reproductive choice is a movement that puts one goal above all. And that goal is enabling women to prevent pregnancy. Now that means through contraception or abortion. In Sanger's day, that meant through contraception. This was her only goal, and it was an especially complicated goal for her because she didn't understand it only as a means of women's choice and women's self-determination. She understood it also as a eugenic goal, as a way to cleanse and improve the quality, the biological quality of the population. And that's because she firmly believed throughout her life that 25% of the world's people were not fit to reproduce. They were of inferior quality, genetically, and especially in terms of mental and physical disability. Her platform of eugenics wasn't actually especially racist. It wasn't a goal of eliminating non-white people. It was a goal of eliminating disability, and disability was a massive category for her, as for many others in her time period. It included things like alcoholism or poverty or many conditions we would no longer now consider to be about biological situation. But so she wanted birth control to prevent pregnancy as a tool of improving the nation and also of enabling some women to get to decide whether or not that they are pregnant. But again, it's a goal that puts sort of like restriction above all. And it's a goal that understands that it positions some women's pregnancies as undesirable, not just for themselves, but for the nation as a whole. And she was involved and cooperated with a lot of the nation's leading eugenicists to make birth control more available. The other view, other approach is represented by Dr. Dorothy Farabee, who is a Black physician led really important health access projects in the Mississippi Delta for sharecroppers especially. And her goal was three parts. It was, yes, helping women prevent pregnancy, but also helping poor women be able to achieve pregnancy in the first place, in light of things like increasing eugenic and sterilization campaigns. And then third, of helping poor women raise children in healthy environments. So it's a more broad-based goal of reproductive justice, as it's now called by Rita Ross, a term she coined in the 1990s, that acknowledges that especially for poor women and Black and Latinx women, the largest barriers to reproductive health and justice are not contraception. It's about access to healthy housing, healthcare, jobs that pay living wages. It's a much more broad-based goal that reflects that broader goal of intersectional feminism altogether.
Yeah, I mean, and that is obviously, like, has stood the test of time. I mean, these people that you cite and that you contrast, I'll admit, the white people are the ones I learned about in history and the ones that I have a better understanding of, and some of these counterexamples, that's why this is so helpful. It doesn't, you know, we didn't learn about that. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, I want to just move a little bit to other examples just before we run out of time, because some of these are really great, including Janice Raymond and Sandy Stone on, and this is applicable to the current day in discussions of TERFs, and J.K. Rowling is the most obvious example, but this is very applicable for modern feminist discourse here. Tell us a little bit about those two feminists and what honestly it says about modern day feminist discourse around trans women.
Yeah, it was really important to me to show how that the logic of anti-trans feminists, you know, who argue that trans women are not women, is actually part of white feminism. Even though it's less obvious, because we most often think of white feminism in terms of its racism, but there is a subliminal racism in the position of TERFs. And so I look at especially the role of a trans musician and sound engineer and activist Sandy Stone, who was part of a really important a lesbian recording artist collective that sold hundreds of thousands of records in the 1970s and 80s called Olivia Records. And then Janice Raymond, who is an academic and author of probably the most important TERF book called The Transsexual Empire, who was supported a campaign to run Sandy Stone, the trans woman, out of Olivia Records in the 70s. And it was a successful campaign. And we often talk about and recognize that anti-trans feminists are what we call biological essentialists, right? They say sex is real. You're born a sex. It's very tidy and clear, and it can never change, right? Biology is destiny, is that kind of logic, which flies in the face of research that shows that anything up to 2% of births are intersex to some degree, right? But it's an insistence that biology is extremely tidy and sex is always straightforward and set in stone. I was absolutely true that TERFs are biological essentialists, but TERFs are also experience essentialists. And what I mean by that is that they say a trans woman can't be a woman also because she didn't have the experience of being a woman growing up. She didn't have the universal experience of menstruation or the universal experience of sexual harassment or any of the other elements of being in a female body. The problem is that there is no such thing as that universal female experience, right? And this is one of the points that Audre Lorde has made over and over again in her lifetime, right? Like, Black women have 5 times the rate of breast cancer, of sexual assault and abuse, right? One of the things that Harriet Jacobs was illuminates versus Harriet Beecher Stowe is that, you know, in the 1860s, what is the position of being a woman? If you're Harriet Jacobs, you might be hiding in an attic for 7 years. If you're an enslaved Black woman being abused by your enslaver, if you're a white woman, you might have a completely different set of experiences. But TERFs ignore all that and say, no, there is just one way to be a woman, and trans women aren't that version, so they can't be women. But that is re-inscribing that universal woman. And the other piece of it is that they also often position men as oppressors, right? And that women need to be protected from men. It's a very simplified view of power where men oppress and women are oppressed. And that's kind of the end of the story for understanding contemporary politics. And that, again, is something that is a lot like white feminism, because if we look back to the Combahee River Collective, you know, famous intersectional feminist group in the 1970s, they made it really clear back in the mid-70s. Often for us as Black women, they said, Black men are more of our allies than white women because we're fighting more concerns than just sex. And that's the kind of dynamic that TERFs can't see. They only see sex and they put everything else secondary. And that's what white feminism is.
Right. And then the point you make about biological essentialism, that is a step away from a white supremacist perspective, right? Where we are these static things and our environment or our skin color or the gender that we have been assigned at birth, that is natural. And anything unnatural is evil in and of itself. And that is very much in keeping with these themes that you've been discussing today.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, my specialty as a scholar is in 19th century race science and the beginnings of a belief in biological essentialism about sex. And it actually turns out that when people got really, really attached to the sex binary, it was as a result of race science. And that literally it was race scientists who said, white people have evolved the sex binary and nobody else has. So you're absolutely right to draw that connection.
And the other thing I want to point out is, like, the idea that a woman's experience, that there is a universal woman's experience, ignores, as you say, all the class and race components to it as well, but ignores the often very traumatic experience of growing up trans in a society that is immensely hostile to that, where that is a set of its own unique experiences and trauma. And then someone like J.K. Rowling has very publicly basically devalued that or said that that is separate and distinct, when obviously there is no way to make that delineation, except if you're trying to reach a conclusion that is bigoted.
Absolutely right. TERFs are insistent that the largest victims of gender are women. And the only victims, you know, but any kind of fight toward, like, who is the biggest victim is not usually going to turn out very well. That's not a very strong place from which to build a movement. But that is one of the many turf errors. Absolutely.
Right. All right. Well, then let's conclude talking about the final, I believe, contrast that you drew between someone like Sheryl Sandberg, author of Lean In, Facebook executive or former Facebook executive, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who everyone is, of course, familiar with here. And that is a contrast really between individual leaning in, right, which is you get yours in the corporate boardroom, right? You make sure you make all the money that you can versus solidarity and working with others. And promoting, she openly talks about intersectionality, AOC does. So talk a little bit about that, and then we can really kind of bring it full circle to where we are at in 2022, which is hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that AOC says things like, I'm not running from the left, I'm running from the bottom. And to me, that is a clear indication of her intersectional politics. And absolutely, she does talk about intersectionality explicitly. Of course, AOC is also of the left, right? But I think she makes that distinction because sometimes the left can be framed as a position that puts class above everything else, right? In the way that feminism is often framed as putting sex above everything else. And she wanted to really signal that's not her position. She's coming from a place that finds race and class to be fully intertwined, and gender inequality to be another thread in that mixture. And one of the examples of how her response to those things is to fight for structural change is that famous speech she gave after Representative Yoho called her a bitch as she was going up the stairs to the Capitol. And she decided, instead of just swallowing it or instead of responding on an individual level, she would give this impromptu speech in front of the House about the structural position of sexism and especially people working in service jobs and the kind of constant sexual harassment and demeaning behavior that they're facing. And of course, her linking up with the ever-expanding squad to fight for a coalitional politics. And that is one of the main lessons of intersectional feminism. It's that the best critique of power is not from the top. It's not about getting yourself to the top. The best critique of power is from the vantage of the bottom. This is one of the things that Combahee River Collective laid out, and the AOC really lives out. But because from the bottom is where you can see all the different layers that make up our power structures in society. But then to actually fight from the bottom, you need to work in coalition with others. And that doesn't mean having perfect alignment in your politics, but being able to work across positions of identity and sometimes also platform to find specific targets you're working on together. And I think AOC's, you know, sometime partnership with the Democrats, often partnership with Democratic Socialists, but then also really crafting her own positions is a great example of that coalitional politics at work. Sandberg, of course, is the opposite. Her view is, she says things like, when women lead half our companies and countries, and men lead half our homes, then we'll have true equality. That's that white feminist version of equality that imagines if you put women at the top of a hierarchy, somehow she will sanctify that hierarchy, right? And I think it's really fascinating how much Sandberg talks about her own emotion and her own fallibility and her own tears. And I really connect it to that phenomenon of white women's tears, only in her case, it's like her tears somehow prove her humanity that sanctify the whole project of corporate capitalism that she's trying to wrestle control over. But that's just changing the face of it. It's not changing any of the structures.
It's like the meme of the pink drones the CNBC segment that went viral of how all of the defense the big defense contractor CEOs are women now. It's like, but yeah, that's very much the dynamic that you're talking about here. Well, I really appreciate your time today. I know we went a little over, but I really appreciate it. Kyla Schuler, the book is called The Trouble Oh, here it is. The Trouble with White Women, A Counter History of Feminism. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much, Emma.
All right, folks. We are out of time, I believe, but that was excellent, truly. I'll never get tired of that topic, to be honest.
Yeah, and the structure of that book where you contrast, a white feminist with a non-white feminist that is overlooked, very smart structure.
I agree.
Particularly for the purpose of a podcast, but just generally, that's very interesting. And because you want to historicize accurately these sorts of like problematic, mythic white feminists that we've had before. But if you just do that, you're still kind of reifying the problem where you're just focusing on them, right?
Yeah.
And you need to actually we need to create basically a new canon of leaders in the struggle.
Right. Right. I mean, I talking about AOC as like this intersectional figure reminds me the worst question I ever asked her. Was like I asked her about identity politics. I must have been like 24 or whatever. I was young, and she did not like the question. I think. And I talked to her about it after, and she was like, "Yeah, I mean, everyone asks me about that, and I don't love it." I was like, "Great, great." It was fine, but I wish that I nailed every question. I did not want to be another one of those idiots asking her about that. But you know, we live and we learn. Regardless, we are going to head into the fun half shortly. But first, Matt, I know you had a marathon Left Reckoning last night.
Yeah, so we did about 5 hours of Left Reckoning, the first main show with Ben Burgess. We also talk about MLK stuff, different reactions. But the main meat of it was Ben Burgess on his new Hitchens book. So we did that, and 3 hours on the post game.
Wow.
We busted out Johnny Walker Black Label because that was Hitchens' favorite drink. But we get into like where he went wrong. If he would have been IDW, I contend that the IDW wouldn't exist as it does now if Hitchens didn't exist, but also that the IDW couldn't exist if Hitchens still existed, because Hitchens, to name one thing, was one of the people woke scolding Charles Murray about being racist back in the 90s, so he wouldn't have put the kibosh on like Sam Harris's little jaunt down race science lane and different things like that. So there's a lot, obviously a lot to talk about with about Hitchens, because we were doing it till 1 a.m. last night. But
wow.
If you want that full postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
That sounds really fun. Shooting the shit with Ben is always fun.
Yeah, and I don't drink a whole lot anymore, because I've stopped going to bars, obviously, for coronavirus generally, and I don't do a whole lot of like drinking at home. But I'm a little bit hungover today, so I'm needing these CBD gummies.
Hair of the dog, aka just alcoholism.
We should have Brandon and Matt
joining
us now. I'm curious to see how Binder's feeling, because he was. You guys there?
Still connecting.
They're both there, but.
Okay. With that said, we'll be taking your calls in the fun half for sure, 646-257-3920. But here is Brandon, and here is Matt. There we go.
Hello.
Wow, at the same time, we're like synchronized today.
Yeah.
And Brandon discovered the G-chat today, so he's been sending some fun messages.
Yeah, I saw that way after. I saw that, like, all these messages from, like, 45 minutes, an hour ago. I'm like, whoa, it's actually being used, the G-chat?
Yeah. I didn't realize we had a group chat. This is the first group chat I've been in that, you know,
we're pretty active in the one with when Sam's here, but I feel like we're more lackadaisical because Sam asked for like extra information a good amount, and we're just flying by the seat of our pants.
Exactly.
Matt, how are you feeling?
I'm doing much better than last week. The last week was the worst. That was something else. Back is still sore though. It's weird. I thought it'd be better by now, but it's definitely not as bad as last week. I'm back in action, at least for the audience. There is a Doomed show tonight. I did a stream on Tuesday as well. Tonight on doomedyoutube.com/MattBinder and on twitch.tv/MattBinder, I'll be talking to Jason Campbell of Media Matters, and we will be walking through a timeline of Steven Crowder's history of just always happening to just work around YouTube's strike policy, just how he always gets away with racking up these strikes. But interestingly enough, you know, he games it in a way where they never quite get racked up to the point where he actually pays a permanent consequence.
Interesting. I wonder why that is, and I guess I'll have to tune into Doomed to find out.
Yeah.
Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
Nothing yet, but I've been trying to get my crew together and to form the Voltron that is our podcast. So, you know, we're gonna get it together in the new year. I promise everybody.
All right.
That was my real New Year's resolution that I didn't want to share. But, you know, we're getting it together. We're not as professional as this outfit, I'm sorry to say.
All right. Well, then with that, we will head into the Funhouse, 646-257-3920. We'll be taking your calls, chatting with you, playing some clips. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the Funhouse.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Dennerke?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
I see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black. Black Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.